First of all, welcome to Waterstones.
Well, thank you.
We are here to talk about James, and this is, well, it's not a retelling as such of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but it is, a recentering of the narrative around the character of Jim. But I wanted to start off actually asking, when you first read Huckleberry Finn, how old were you, and what did you make of it?
Well, my first experience with Huck Finn was probably 7 or 8 years old, but it was an abridged version.
Okay.
I can't tell you what made it abridged, only that it was much shorter and was essentially only an adventure. And I must say, I wasn't terribly moved by it in any way. I didn't like Tom Sawyer at all.
Yeah.
But I did respond a little more favorably to Huck Finn. Then I read it later as a teenager.
And it's a book which is, I would say, sort of really heavily ingrained in US culture. It's very popular over here in the UK, but there is obviously something very different about US culture that it speaks to. And it's not actually a book that I read as a kid, but why do you think it remains so, so ingrained in UK literary culture, sorry, US literary culture?
It's been so long a part of the canon, and it was taught much more than it is now in schools. It's a bit like Moby Dick.
Hmm.
I would venture to say that most Americans have not read Moby Dick, but they know it's a story about a whale.
Right.
And so, and it occupies a space in the literary landscape like that. But it has a real importance. It's the first time that an American novel tells its story in the vernacular, which gave a lot of people some trouble. And it's also quite clearly, as a story of a young boy, it's that young boy is a young America wandering through the landscape in a way that no one had before, dealing with what was and would continue to be the most defining feature of the American experience, which is race.
Mm. I can imagine that a lot of those books, as you say, that are in the canon, they remain sort of with their lofty status, the kind of books that you don't touch. We live actually in an age now where there's a lot of retelling going on, a lot of people picking up those books and looking at them again. I wonder when you first got the idea of wanting to tell the story from Jim's perspective.
I wish I had a better story for that. Three years ago, I asked myself the question, has anyone told this from Jim's point of view? And so I did a little research, and as far as I could find out, no one had. Mm-hmm. And then I wondered why no one had, and I realized in 64 years I hadn't thought of it either. And so I embarked on that.
It seems to me that one of the really key things in this book is this idea of voice. And Jim, or James, to give him his proper name, has almost three distinct voices in the book. There is the narrative voice that we read, there is the real speaking voice that he has when he's talking to other black people in the book, and then there is the slave voice that he employs, the one that, as you say, that we're used to from the original book. And you do this brilliant thing, which is to show that the slave voice, if you like, is an act that he's putting on in order to protect himself, to allow the white characters to hear what they expect to hear. Tell me a little bit about developing those three distinct voices, because there is also a very subtle difference between the written narrative voice and the voice that he speaks with in the book.
Well, addressing that one first, there is always a different writing voice. One that's, it has the benefit of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about present tense, but nothing is present tense. And so those voices are distinct for that reason. And then there are the performative voice of the slave language that the enslaved people in the novel have to employ in order to be safe in the world. They have to comply with the expectations that white people have of them, else they'd be deemed dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And I guess is that idea as well, that they are wanting to appear unthreatening, uneducated, stupid in many ways. You know, that's how they're treated.
Yes.
Whereas James is an autodidact, that he's, you know, he has got these books that he is using to teach himself. And I suppose that plays into that narrative voice as well, that, as you say, it's clearly being written at a point where his learning has increased, and so it has a slightly more educated sound to it. Is that fair?
It's yes, and it's also the case that when writing, one is writing to an audience differently from the way one speaks to an individual.
Mm. This idea of voice is, of course, featured in your novel Erasure, which was turned into the film American Fiction. Again, an author having to put on a voice that is expected of a black writer in order to get fame and notoriety. Can you tell me a little bit about that? For you as a writer, this idea of what black voices are supposed to sound like according to some readers or cultural commentators, and therefore finding the sort of authentic way of writing.
Well, the seed of the problem lies in the fact that we can talk about black voices.
Right.
You hardly ever hear someone say white voices. The racism is insinuated quite insidiously into the language. There is no black voice. Mm. That's a myth.
Mm.
And one that's employed and used repeatedly by, you know, educators, people in entertainment, people in the publishing industry, to try to authenticate works and have them be representative of something that they cannot represent because it does not exist.
Mm. You have gone through something that a lot of writers go through, which is to hand over a novel for somebody else to adapt for the screen. Mm-hmm. with Erasure. And obviously it's gone on to have huge success as a screenplay. And I know that you've had your own Oscars experience with everything that's been going on. But how have you reacted to that? And how has it been to hand over that book to somebody like Cord Jefferson to adapt? And
well, first of all, I like Cord Jefferson very much, and I was happy to turn the book over to him. I don't have proprietary feelings about my novels. I'm glad that the product was good and that the film was as enjoyable as it is. I never expected to see my novel on screen. What I like is that he was able to mine my work to make his film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's supposed to do. They're different media, and it should be a completely new and different work of art.
You're listed as one of the sort of, you know, people connected to the film as a producer, but did that mean that you had much sort of involvement in it, or were you there simply to sort of?
Oh no, they gave me that credit instead of money.
Okay, that old trick. And you know, that Erasure is one of many novels that you've written. You're actually an incredibly prolific writer, and I wondered whether there was a common impetus to get you started on a new project.
I wish I could tell you. I wish I knew. It's making stuff is my way of being in the world, and apparently it's a disease, and I can't help it.
But does that mean that it's sort of is it something that you're constantly thinking about? Do you work on multiple ideas at the same time, or do you very much sort of fix on one thing and work to completion and then move on to the next?
It varies. There have been times when I've worked on a couple of things at once. That's probably preferable, but it's not the way it usually is.
Mm.
I become obsessed with what I think might be a subject, and I study and study and study, and turns out I didn't need to study any of that to write what I end up writing, but it gives me permission.
Yeah. With the writing of James, we're going to have to be very careful here, because there is a central strand of the story.
We won't talk about the spaceship.
No one's expecting that. That is an absolute revelatory, I guess, perspective on the story that people will be familiar with. And I wondered whether that was something that you sort of, I guess, invented and imposed on the story, or whether it was simply a case of, when rereading that book, it was something that made logical sense to you, and therefore you decided to write it.
I think both. It's not present in Huck Finn, and I think Twain would have been surprised by that. But I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility, and it explains certain behaviors that actually do exist in Twain's novel.
Mm. I was going to ask actually what you think Twain would make of your book if he got the chance to read it.
I think he'd be incredibly pissed that it's making money. I flatter myself to think that I'm in conversation with Twain in making this novel. And everything I know about him from reading him has me think that he would enjoy it.
As we were saying, sort of, it was a book that you had read when you were very young, come back to when you were a teenager, and then obviously come back to again now. Did you find yourself, because there's obviously, with the original, Jim comes and goes, and what you do is to, of course, show us what happened in those gaps. And I had sort of a vision of you with sort of post-it notes on a wall working out where people are at various times and then knowing what
that's
you used to
think.
That's
a good idea. Maybe.
I was going to say, how did you plan it out? Wasn't that sort of planned out? Or?
Well, the first thing I did, because I didn't want to inhabit the text, I wanted to inhabit the world. And so I needed to know the world without remembering Twain's novel. So I read Huck Finn maybe 15 times continuously. I would end it and start again until it was just a blur, nonsense, until I hated it. And then I still haven't looked at Huck Finn again since then. Don't know if I could stand to. And that allowed me, again, to inhabit that world, and what was present in that world that was important found its way into my text. So I wasn't really using The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as a map so much as remembering a world that I had inhabited.
And as part of that, inhabiting that world, I mean, did you do the kind of research that some authors would do, which is to visit those places to have a feel for the landscape, or has it changed too much from the period that it was written in for that to be useful?
Oh, of course it's changed significantly. I mean, they're still slaves, but I did at one point visit Hannibal, Missouri, and found myself getting out of Hannibal, Missouri as quickly as I got into it. It was completely without profit for me writing the novel. If I were to write a novel set in Hannibal, Missouri now, that would be a great
thing.
Because I think novelty shops and gift stores are a place for important stories. Really, it was inhabiting Twain's world that informed my being able to make this.
There's a moment in the book where a character called Young George gives some advice to James about the writing of his memoir, and he says, "Use your ears." Could you tell me what he means by that and why that's sort of important advice?
Well, he's a lot smarter than I am, and so I'm not sure I know what he means. One thing that we don't do is we talk a lot, but we don't listen. And I think we learn a lot more about communication from listening. I heard an old man say something that I'm going to get it wrong. Maybe I didn't listen well enough. He said, "We've been given two ears and one mouth, and we should use them in that proportion." I always like that.
That is a good phrase. The other thing that seems really important in the book is this idea of James writing his own story. And he talks about having this pencil and using it to create himself. The pencil actually is incredibly important in the book for all sorts of reasons. And that leads me to think that you obviously still feel that storytelling is incredibly important. Does it still have the power to affect change in the way that a novel like Twain's may have done in terms of America's history in the past?
Well, if I didn't have some foolhardy hope that's possible, I wouldn't be doing it. Yeah, I well, reading to me is really the most subversive thing we can do. But we need something to read to practice that subversion. And so writing is therefore important. It doesn't generate the meaning. It allows the reader to generate the meaning that she or he needs to move forward.
And just to finish off, there will be those like me who aren't hugely familiar with Twain's original books, and then of course those who are very familiar with them from reading them in their childhood. But what do you hope any reader might get from picking up James?
Oh, some truth about the world, about the importance of being true to oneself. And again, the subversive nature of not just reading, but the idea of literacy.
That's a very fine note on which to end. Percival, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.